This is The Trend on WNIN. I'm John Gibson, and we're diving into books today, fiction and poetry rooted in the tri-state. We'll hear from poet Marcus Wicker, who teaches at USI and heads up the New Harmony Writers Series. We'll also speak with Kay Brown, one of the organizers of this week's Common Reading Program in Owensboro. And we'll also hear from local poet and musician Peggy Pirro, whose new book of poetry has just been released. But my first guest is an Evansville native who has since lived around the world, but he never forgot Southern Indiana. That's made clear in his first novel, Snapper. It's a funny and biting book about growing up in this area, falling in love, and studying birds for a couple of years. Brian Kimmerling, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, John. Happy to be here.
All right, I think we may be having a little trouble with your mic. We'll see if we can get you up there. I think we'll be fine.
Thank you for having me, John.
Yeah, there you go. Sounds great. All right, well, let's talk now about the structure of Snapper. It seems to me that it almost reads like a series of short stories or episodes with recurring characters, not exactly a straight line narrative. Why did you choose to structure it like that?
Well, I meant to write a collection of stories. I didn't know that they would start talking to each other as I wrote, and eventually a narrative line emerged in the background. I don't call it a collection or a novel. I call it a book.
I see.
The people who sell it have to market it in a certain way, but for me, it grew organically and became what it is.
So you don't see it so much as a novel? You don't really see it as a collection of short stories, just something in between, perhaps?
I hope it's in the same line as Sherwood Anderson's Waynesburg, Ohio, or Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon stories, which don't quite form a novel, but they form more than a collection of stories.
Yeah. Now, each chapter of the book, it's about 200 pages. Each chapter has its own title. And the second chapter shares the book's title, Snapper. Now, it's as I saw it, it was a funny and somewhat traumatic story about a confrontation that the lead character and a friend have with a snapping turtle. I guess my question is, why did you choose to make that chapter the title of the whole book?
My editor and I did kick around some alternative titles, and none of them really had the scope of something that sits a little off stage. But the turtle that you referred to exerted a very powerful hold on my imagination, and it was a kind of metaphor for the land and the things that grow out of it, which are kind of hideous and majestic and quite dangerous at the same time.
Right. The turtle, well, there was an incident involving a toe. Let's say that,
Joe. Right.
So as you see it, the turtle incident does have a sort of a special meaning for the whole story.
Yeah, I hope it's a very funny book. You called it a funny book, but a lot of people come to grim fates and they wind up injured or in prison, and it's not a pleasant world described in the book.
Yeah, well, we mentioned the recurring characters that keep coming around, and perhaps the most significant is Lola. She seems to be an elusive young woman who your character loves. How would you describe Lola?
She's from Evansville, like the narrator Nathan Lockmuller, and they meet. This isn't made explicit in the book, but they meet in Greeley's, the restaurant that used to be in the old post office.
Right.
And I used to work in Greeley's.
I see.
And there are a lot of things like that in the book that long-term Evansville residents might recognize.
And so, yeah, she's sort of, she seems to almost always be in the background as we go through these stories.
Yeah.
Always part of your character's, she's always on his mind, it seems.
I think in the end, he doesn't ever really know her. And that's part of his unhappiness. That he doesn't really, just to summarize the book a little bit, he spends about 8 years as a freelance bird researcher. And he crisscrosses southern Indiana, but studying the birds is really a pretext for encountering certain varieties of Hoosier humanity. In any case, at the end of it, he's not sure what to make of his experience, and he's not really sure what to make of Lola or their relationship, which has been on and off for all those 8 years.
Yeah. Would you describe it as, with these stories all together, I mean, something of a coming-of-age story?
Yes, certainly. I think Nathan and Lola are the central characters ostensibly, but there's another big character in there, and that's the state of Indiana.
Right.
So it's partly a coming-of-age story, but it's also a portrait of this area.
And I think it's safe to say that Snapper It's not exactly a flattering piece about Evansville or Indiana in general. What kind of reactions have you received from, say, people who live here?
Mostly positive, which is a great relief.
I
did a reading at Barnes & Noble when the hardcover came out, and I sort of worried it might be a book burning rather than a book signing, but
yes.
People appreciated it. It's not... the book takes a lot of digs at Evansville and Southern Indiana generally, but it does acknowledge certain romantic things in the past, like the heroic manufacturing that Evansville did during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in it should be taken at face value.
Well, then I think some people did, or some people maybe felt a little offended. After all, I mean, you grew up here, but you moved away. And a lot of folks who maybe grew up with you, you know, are still here. And we talked about this a little bit before coming on the air. Some people go, some people stay, some people leave and come back. What is your take on Evansville specifically, and why some people can't leave soon enough and others find themselves staying here for life?
Well, when Mitch Daniels was reelected, he talked about the Hoosier inferiority complex, which was an interesting phrase. I don't know if he was reelected as state psychiatrist or what, but
I believe it was governor, but yes.
Yeah. And I think that's true of the state generally, and especially of Evansville, because we are isolated from the rest of the state, mm-hmm. right down at the bottom with only half a road going to the Capitol.
Yeah.
And in many ways closer, well, geographically closer to Kentucky, but culturally too, with a different accent and, so.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your book that we some seem like a bit of an extension of Kentucky in some ways.
Yeah, ecologically, the Angel Mounds, I think, is the northernmost pecan grove of its kind, and then over at Hovey Lake, that's a cypress swamp that is as north as such cypress swamps occur. That's in the book too. It says as though two slender southern fingers were reaching up to pinch Evansville in between them.
And. I know what you mean. In fact, I've heard folks joking, I assume, that perhaps we should secede from Indiana, join Kentucky. At least we have a direct highway to Frankfort. So, do you feel that the success of this book is something of a payback for enduring your time here?
No, I don't really feel that way. I don't feel that I endured my time here. I think Evansville was a great place to grow up, and my views are not necessarily the views of the narrator.
Right.
Snapper is a work of fiction, and it's not my job to represent Evansville accurately. It's my job to tell a good story.
Sure. Yeah, and that was my next question, and it's a question that I'm sure you're asked a lot. I mean, how much, of the book, how much is the character Nathan Lockmuir, how much of that is autobiographical?
I think... a lot of the incidents and details of Nathan's life are borrowed or made up, borrowed from people I know and so on. And in the piece that you asked me to read in a minute,
mm-hmm.
there are a few lines I stole from my brother outright.
I see.
But the emotional arc of coming from Evansville and being a little bit ambivalent about it and then fleeing at mm-hmm. age 18, that is true to my life.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. And the bird studying, that is something you did as well?
For two summers in the mid-90s, I was a research assistant for an IU study of songbirds. The catch is I wasn't very good at it, owing to a hearing impairment.
Oh.
And I was really jealous of the people who were, so much so that 17 years later, I fabricated a career that I didn't have in book form.
Uh-huh.
And I embellished it. So Nathan's career in the book really spans about 8 years, and he goes all over and he works for different government agencies and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really do that.
I see. The impediment you had, I mean, did that deprive you from hearing the bird calls, the bird singing, that kind of thing?
I could hear them, but I couldn't tell where they were. So while everyone else knew exactly, I would turn around in circles and feel really stupid.
I see. Well, yeah, why don't we turn to chapter 2 of Snapper here. This chapter, or this story, is in fact called Snapper. It shares the title with the book, the entire book. Brian Kimmerling, if you could, maybe the first page and a half there. I think a lot of folks will enjoy this.
Okay. Snapper. I doubt anyone outside Southern Indiana knows what a stripper pit is. They don't exist anywhere else. This is sometimes embarrassing for me in conversation if I say I spent many happy adolescent hours there. People think I'm talking about Thong Thursdays at Fast Eddie's. The British Broadcasting Corporation once sent a reporter by boat to Evansville to investigate the wild ways of the inhabitants. The kind of thing they used to do in deepest Africa, I think. We are Hoosiers, after all. On a technical level, a stripper pit is what remains of a bituminous coal mine, but strip mining is not like other mining. Picture vast granite cliffs topped with coniferous trees, deep lakes of calm cerulean blue. Imagine a majestic Norwegian fjord somehow misplaced among rolling cornfields. That is what a stripper pit looks like. At the bottom of those lakes, you'll find old refrigerators and stolen cars and bags of kittens. It is Southern Indiana. Before the mining company got to it, it was woodland or farmland or, in some cases, small towns. The beauty of strip mining, if you're a mining company, is that you don't have to dig for your coal. You just scrape everything off the top for several surrounding square miles. Then you scrape yourself a lucrative pit where the bituminous is piled deepest. Some people will tell you it's anthracite, but they're wrong. Even the coal around there is second rate. The only downside to this kind of operation is that even Hoosiers won't tolerate the total obliteration of the landscape for long. So if you were a strip mine in about 1973, you found yourself suddenly filled with water and stocked with fish. Your hillsides were covered in alien trees. The mining company was footing the bill, and they weren't fussy. Overnight, you got used to deer and raccoons and possums, rattlesnakes and songbirds and foxes, wild dogs and butterflies. Not long after that, you lost count of the hunters and anglers and campers and delinquent kids setting fire to things.
That is, I think, quite a beautiful description of young life in Southern Indiana. Stripper pits are rare, I guess. Nobody else has them. Did you yourself spend much time swimming in stripper pits?
Not swimming, but fishing with my dad from age, 2 to 10 or 12 or 15. Uh-huh. And I think if you go out to Warwick County now, you find a lot more no trespassing signs, and it's harder to find a good stripper pit. But when I was growing up, that was a big part of my childhood.
Yeah, and I recall growing up, too. I don't believe I ever swam in one either, but they were something that was always talked about. It seemed like a real, almost a rite of passage for young people to go to the stripper pits. Can you tell us, your literary influences? Who do you read? Who do you like? Who do you feel inspired you to write something like Snapper?
That's a tricky question because, I can tell you who my influences are, but mm-hmm. when I read Snapper for the first time, so to speak, when I had finished it, I uh-huh. couldn't detect any of those. I grew up reading Southern short stories, particularly Peter Taylor, Catherine Ann Porter, mm-hmm. Eudora Welty. And I also am a huge fan of the Irish short story writer Frank O'Connor. Mm-hmm. You can see the short story influence there.
Right, right.
But they lived in a completely different world, and I couldn't describe my world in the language that they used. So at some point, I felt myself trying to let Indiana tell the story, and uh-huh. I was just an interpreter.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned, and of course, we want to keep in mind that this is fiction. These are characters. It's not necessarily you saying these things. But, Indiana does come in for a lot of criticism. I think your character at one point calls Indianapolis the worst city in the world. Where does that come from? I mean, as you say, it's fiction, but where does this anger, this desire to flee Indiana, where does that all come from?
I tried to write a scene in New Harmony, and I thought New Harmony is too charming for the book that I've started to write.
I see.
Like, once I started to riff on the Indiana bashing, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. I couldn't write about First Street in Evansville or the old post office or all the charming things that uh-huh. might go into book two. Ambivalence is the right word. It's not entirely negative, and uh-huh. there are many things that I enjoy in Evansville, but I couldn't put them into this book because I had made a character who was relentlessly derogatory.
I see. Well, so you do have some soft spots for the Evansville area. I mean, now that you've left here many years ago, you've lived various locations around the world. I think most recently in London or England. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, you've moved back now to Bloomington. What are some of the soft spots, I guess, here at Evansville? Things that stick out in your mind, things you like to see when you do, in fact, come back.
The Ohio River is number 1, 2, and 3 on the list. Uh-huh. I always go straight to see it. I went to see it right before this interview. Mm-hmm. It's a big presence in the book, too.
Yes.
Tironi's house special is probably number 4.
I see. Uh-huh.
And there are various other things.
Uh-huh. Well, you mentioned some of the historical landmarks, things you enjoy, the old post office.
Which I learned while I was in England is in a Ruskinian Gothic style, which is the same as St. Pancras Station in London.
Is that right?
And I had to travel to learn that, but it's a special building. And as I said, I worked in Greeley's. I helped paint it when it became the Boston Bay Fish Company, and I felt like I was helping to inter a venerable Evansville institution. We're going back 20 years now.
Sure. Now, did you check out that station in England?
Oh, yeah. It's much bigger.
But
It does look similar.
I see. You know, the book also reminds me a bit of a favorite of mine, growing up, a coming-of-age story, also a very good movie, The Last Picture Show. And at the same time, Larry McMurtry's book, when it was released back in the 60s, drew a lot of ire. Maybe it was a bit scandalous. Again, people feeling like their dirty laundry is being put out there for the world to see. Have you encountered that kind of feeling from anybody?
Well, not face to face.
Yeah.
Nobody's really punched me on the jaw.
Uh-huh.
I think some reviewers have said that Nathan seems awfully resentful for someone so privileged, which I think is fair enough. That's accurate. But that he's also a human being, so I don't feel too bad about that.
Right. Now, this was your first collection published, is that right?
Yeah, I wrote several plays that I produced in at small theaters in England. And those were very good training for writing a novel because I learned to enjoy writing dialogue, for example.
Uh-huh.
And I learned to set scenes a little better, a little more economically. And I picked up a sense of comic timing by watching things go wrong again and again and again in a black box during rehearsals.
Uh-huh. So what's next? Are you working on another novel, a follow-up to this? What can we expect in the future?
I am working on another book in Southern Indiana, set in Southern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And because I haven't lived here for 17 years, it seemed like a good idea to move back. That's why we've been in Bloomington since October 1st.
Uh-huh.
But this one's in limestone country
around
Bloomington. And I'm very interested in the quarries up there. I live about 19 miles away from the quarry where the Empire State Building originated, and it looks like they just pulled it out of the ground intact and set it walking to New York.
Uh-huh.
It's a beautiful area, but you know, there's not a lot of activity around there now. New York got a very good deal out of that, and Indiana is got a lot less limestone.
Yeah. And you were just recently in New York. You looked at the Empire State Building.
Oh yeah, I walked down and looked up and took a picture, and I said, "I know where you're from."
Is that does that seem to sort of fit into this idea that maybe Indiana, the inferiority complex you were talking about earlier? I mean, here's this material from Indiana. It's a huge part of this giant landmark in New York City, but here in Indiana, not so much. You don't see so much of it.
Well, this may be the Brian who lived in England for 10 years speaking, but I think Indiana is run something like a colony, and all the timber and coal and steel and bright young 18-year-olds are exported somewhere else. And that leaves behind a place that's hard to call home sometimes.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned some soft spots you have for Evansville. If this next book is going to be based in Southern Indiana as well, are you anticipating a different tone, or maybe a different location for your next characters?
Well, there'll be more Bloomington than Evansville, I'll put it that way. But I'm sure Evansville will crop up. And yes to the different tone.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little about your process of writing a novel or a bunch of stories as you have here? for me, it's always seemed just impossible to sit down and write 200 pages of something. You know, I mean, I write news stories. I write, you know, short stories, news headlines, those kinds of things. The idea of sitting down and writing a 200-page novel has always seemed sort of beyond me. What is your process of writing?
I had written at least three of the stories in Snapper before I realized they could be the same narrator.
Uh-huh.
So then I had to do a whole lot of work to rewrite them. Mm-hmm. And most of what I do is rewriting and revision. I didn't have a plan. I uh-huh. kind of, as I said, I tried to let Indiana tell the story, and I was just choosing the words.
How long does it take to put together a 200-page novel or a series of short stories?
It took me about 18 months, but that's misleading because I wrote maybe 60 or 70% of it in 6 months, and then I hit this wall and I couldn't get past it. And then I had another little spurt, and I, you know, so if I did it as efficiently as possible, it wouldn't take me long at all, but I can't do it that way.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you hit a sort of a writer's block at one point.
Well, of all the things that I wrote, there are a whole lot of things that didn't make it into the book. Like I said, I tried to write about New Harmony, and that was a few months before I realized, no, actually, New Harmony is just too quaint and charming to fit in this book, to fit in the description of Indiana as I had already started.
Right. And that stalled you a little bit?
Yeah.
So, let's see. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left here. Anything else about the book that we haven't touched on? There's certainly a lot to talk about. I don't know if you want to read another page or two.
Well, you know, I'm excited to be speaking to people in Evansville because there's a scene. This is the scene I always read in when I'm on the road doing events,
mm-hmm.
set in Santa Claus, Indiana.
Oh, uh-huh.
And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, or at least that section, is I'm not sure that anyone ever wrote about Santa Claus, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
However, any resident of some duration will recognize that I'm actually writing about bustlers, the old bustlers on 41.
On Highway 41, just north of Evansville,
and
right?
I think there are a lot of thinly disguised landmarks in the book that might appeal to local readers.
Yes, the large fiberglass Santa Claus or plastic, I'm not sure what right. it was, that sat up there for many, many years. It has disappeared, you know.
It has. I know. It breaks my heart. I did a reading in Indianapolis, and afterwards someone came up to me and said that her father built that.
Hmm.
So, small world.
Yeah. I don't know the whereabouts of it now. I heard some reports that it had been moved, actually, to Santa Claus, Indiana, believe right. it or not. I'm not sure if that's the case or not. But, well, anything else you'd like to read from the book before we go?
Sure. I'll, if I can find
so long as it's radio friendly, of course.
Yeah, of course. The whole thing's radio friendly.
Okay.
Just
a page or two, sure.
Yeah.
Whatever you like.
The gypsy moth wasn't what you'd call roadworthy, but I kept her a wheel for a while. The radiator had two big cracks, and I discovered these in the middle of nowhere, so I plugged them with bread for my sandwich. 10 miles later, I had toast. After that, I kept an 8-gallon plastic canister in the passenger seat and refilled it every time I passed a lake. When necessary, I pulled over and poured lake water into the radiator, along with a few tadpoles. I thought she could use the protein. I found other leaks of other fluids all over the underside of the truck, and I patched these up with duct tape or chewing gum, depending what I had on hand. At that time, I was crisscrossing Indiana, counting birds for the Department of Natural Resources, and I generally had to make my repairs deep in the forest somewhere. You can use water for brake fluid, too. I promise.
That's Brian Kimmerling reading from his novel, Snapper. It's just been released in paperback. It was released last year, a hardcover. I'm sure you can still get that. But available now in paperback. It was also named one of the best books of the year by NPR. Brian, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on the book. And we hope you'll come back again sometime.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, coming up on The Trend, we'll hear from poet and USI professor Marcus Wicker. He heads up the New Harmony Writers Series. And later in the program, Peggy Pirro will join us to discuss her new book of poems. Please stay with us. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Support comes from Evansville Day School, presenting Princeton Review's SAT Ultimate Preparation Course, taught by a Princeton Review instructor. Two sessions will be offered this summer, June 9th to 26th and July 7th to 24th. Space is limited. Registration information at evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Thank you for joining us. The University of Southern Indiana's English program is home to some illustrious writers, including Marcus Wicker. He's the author of Maybe the Saddest Thing, a collection of poetry that was selected by D.A. Pell for the National Poetry Series. My co-host Cass Harrington caught up with Wicker to hear about his work with New Harmony's Writers' Workshop, which brings in notable authors and poets from across the country.
Our program this week is on literature here in the tri-state.
Oh, great.
We're talking with local writers, novelists. Also, WNIN has a partnership with New Harmony, so we're particularly interested in your work there.
Great.
So let's start there. What exactly is this writer series that you're directing?
Well, the New Harmony Writers Workshop was formerly Rope Walk. It's a week-long study of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction in New Harmony. Participants from University of Southern Indiana, from grad schools in the area, community members, anybody who wants to study, who already writes, will have the opportunity to come and workshop with writers of national merit and also be around fellow writers for a week in New Harmony and sort of get inspired.
So for this summer, do you have people lined up?
We do. Great lineup. There's Adrian Matika, who was one of the four finalists for the National Book Award in 2013. He'll be there. There's another poet. Her name is Erica Meitner. She's got several books. She teaches at Virginia Tech in the graduate program there. The fiction writer is Christine Sneed. She's the author of two novels, Big Deal. She's from Chicago. And then there are fellows to actually help, facilitate writing exercises so that you could create there, not just workshop stuff that you've previously written.
What interest do they have in coming to Southern Indiana for this sort of thing? Writers, I mean, they're not making much money.
This is true.
You know, there are other things they could be doing. So why teach and lead a workshop?
Well, I think New Harmony is beautiful. It's so serene. Ever since the Harmonists and the Owenites of the 19th century, it's always been a place for expression and freedom of ideas. And I think the writers know that who are going to teach here.
Uh-huh.
And also, it's just so pretty. It's not overly inhabited. You could walk around with your thoughts. It's the perfect spot.
For a poet?
For a retreat. Yeah, for a poet or a fiction writer.
Huh.
Yeah.
Do you feel particularly inspired when you're there?
I do. When I first came to USI, I spent a week and a half there just writing and walking and meeting people. And it really helped, I guess, get me used to the landscape of Southern Indiana, and there's just sort of a power there. I don't know. It's indescribable. Yeah.
Well, Marcus, I know that you are relatively new to Southern Indiana. You went to IU.
I did.
But you're from Ann Arbor, Michigan. So what have your observations been of writers in Indiana or how people think creatively here? Is there something different?
I think that, you know, when you think about literature, you think major metropolitan cities, you think New York, you think Los Angeles, and the writers here, I think because they don't have to deal with that pressure of it being competitive in nature, they end up producing more competitive art. I think that there are really elite poets. Matthew Graham, who teaches at USI, is one of them. Nicole Reed is a fiction writer. They're all people who publish nationally. Purdue and IU, all great writers and teachers there, but just in the state of Indiana, there are so many folks like Michael Martone that's published several novels, won these big awards. So you don't always think about Indiana when you think authors, but it's a hot spot.
For really?
Them, I think. Yeah. Huh.
What about yourself? Since you've lived here, has your style changed or your content?
Well, this next book, it's called Cul-de-Sac Pastoral, and I'm writing about suburbia, and maybe some of the landscape is Ann Arbor. It's hard to write about home when you're there.
Right.
So just being away here in southern Indiana has given me perspective to look back, I'd say.
Something to compare, I'm sure.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so your debut collection, Maybe the Saddest Thing, came out last year. And the reception has been pretty impressive. I saw a write-up in Slate magazine and won some accolades from the Poetry Foundation.
It did. Thank you. I was surprised. I'm very happy. Very happy about it.
You were surprised?
I was surprised.
I read some and it was very, I thought it was refreshing how you talk about pop culture so plainly. Why is that something you focus on?
Well, I think that it's easy to point the finger at pop culture and say it's what's wrong with, you know, contemporary society. It's easy to sort of downplay its importance. But I think that the things that happen behind pop culture are complicated. And so part of the project of the book is to give that topic some levity, some weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that something you impress upon your students?
No. Not so much. I tell them don't write about pop culture.
Really? Do as I say, not as I do.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
So what is the overall mission of this workshop in New Harmony? What do you hope to derive out of this?
Well, I think the unique thing about the New Harmony Writers Workshop is that it serves participants on all levels. There are plenty of workshops you could go to, like Bread Loaf, like, you know, the Vermont Studio Center, where you're only going to work with, I guess, sort of advanced compatriots. But part of the project of the workshop this summer is to take writers at all different levels, meet each other where you're at, and sort of share work, right? Share work together and learn from one another just as much as you learn from those fantastic instructors that will be there.
A wealth of them.
Yeah, a wealth of them. And so it's a community thing. Even if you don't sign up for the actual week-long retreat there, all of our authors will give readings. There'll be craft lectures. We've got a guy from Pleiades Magazine. His name is Phong Nguyen. He's sort of our editorial fellow. It's like one of the biggest magazines in the country. He'll be there to talk about publishing your own work. We want this to be something that people come out to in droves.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you see writing? I mean, could it be... I hate to think in terms of, I mean, it's so pragmatic to think about money, but could it be Indiana's export?
No.
No?
No, but I think maybe an export of ideas, right? A way to put Indiana on the map in a positive light, in a more positive light, certainly.
Well, Marcus, anything I might have missed?
Well, one thing that I do want to say, in preparation for the New Harmony Writers Workshop, we're bringing Adrian Matika to campus. Next month is National Poetry Month.
Well, there you go.
And so he'll be there April 23rd, 5 o'clock at Claymire at USI. And he's a national treasure. I mean, hundreds of people are nominated for the National Book Award. But to be one of the four finalists really says a lot. His book is about Jack Johnson, the first African-American heavyweight champion, parents of slaves. The book is certainly about more than that, though. You should come.
When can we expect your collection to come out?
I'm working towards the second collection. I'm also working towards a memoir, you know, when it's finished.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out.
Okay.
Meantime, come back.
Sure. I'd love that.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
That was my co-host Cass Harrington speaking with Marcus Wicker, Assistant Professor of English at USI and Director of the New Harmony Writers Workshop, which is this June. We'll have more information available on that at the Trends page on WNIN.org. Well, professional writers mingled with students this week in Owensboro at the Common Reading Program. Kay Brown is one of the organizers of the event at Owensboro Community and Technical College. She told me that Common Reading celebrated its 10th year this week.
In the beginning, we came up with a kind of grassroots idea. I was part-time at that time. I was an adjunct faculty member, and a lot of us talked about it. I was here all the time, even part-time, and we said, gosh, it'd be really cool. I had a lot of students that would say they had never read a book. I don't know how they got out of high school with that. We think they were might have been fibbing just a little bit, but I said, man, that's a shame. And I said, let's think about this. Not just me, but a bunch of us talked about it. And we said, well, I wonder if it'd be cool to have, like, all the students in some of the English classes read the same book and have discussions related to that. So it started out like that. And then we started feeling like it would be very cool to have the authors come and visit after the students had read the book. And the students' reaction to that was really great. You know, they were like, wait a minute. The author of this book we're reading is going to come to Owensboro and talk to us. And I think it's just kind of a special connection to make, you know. And the students really, I love to wait in line while the students are having their books signed and talk to the students as they're waiting to have their books signed. That's my favorite thing to do because, you know, they're just so enthused about being there and meeting this person that thinks enough of them to come and visit them after they read their book.
So you feel like you're increasing an appreciation of books and writing there in the Owensboro area?
I hope so. I hope we all are. You know, it's not just me. It's a big group, and we have tons of people that help us. And I hope so. The NEH grant that we applied for, I had gone to Washington, D.C. to the National Endowment people and said, hey, we keep applying for these grants and we're competing against such huge entities that, you know, we feel like we're never going to be able to come out on top. And while I was there, they said, you know, we're thinking about doing a community college division. I said, I think that'd be a great idea. So it was several years later when that grant opportunity came up, and it's no longer available. It was available for about 2 years, and we were the first of seven community colleges to get one of those grants. And it required us to go into the community and match the federal grant, and that really made us complete partnerships with our local groups, the Davis County Public Library, the museum, the other colleges in town, because it made us reach out into the community and say, hey, let's all do something similar, not the same, but if you guys have an exhibit on China, the semester we're doing a book on China, we can tell our community college students to come down to your museum. We'll give them extra credit. And we think it has helped pull our students, you know, out into the community, take their kids to the museum, whereas they wouldn't have done that before. So we feel like all of that has been a really good thing.
Have you seen a lot of writing talent around Owensboro?
Yes, we feel like that it is another growing thing. The third Tuesday writer coffee house we have, we don't have it. Brescia sponsors it, but we've been participating pretty much over the past several years. And people come and read their writing, local people, and it's really fun to see people get up and showcase their talents. And I think that writers need that. They need to have that way to communicate with one another and things like that.
Now
our students, too. I think they have written about what they've read, and I think they're showing a lot of critical thinking skills, applying things. There's domestic violence in the book we've read this semester, and I've had students say, you know, gosh, this reminded me of a situation that I saw. One of the men has a stroke in the book, and so many of the students have, you know, opened up and written about relatives who've had a stroke and gotten that down on paper. And I, you know, we all feel like that's a very positive thing about literature.
So what do young writers learn at Common Reading? What do you hope they come away with?
That their story's important, that their own stories are important, that Kentucky stories and what happened to their grandparents and their parents is a story, and if you write it down, then they go on living forever because, you know, that story's down on paper. And I hope they learn that. I hope they learn about writing that it's a craft, and you start out and you get ideas down on paper and comb it hair and polish it, and before you know it, you will have something that everybody gets what you're trying to say.
Now, you mentioned how everybody was reading one book, sort of focusing on one book. Is that a trend we're seeing? I know here in Evansville, we just recently had the big read at USI, also the One Book, One Community program. Is that those kinds of things? Are those growing? And what comes from that sort of one book, one community idea?
Well, the Big Read, we did get a Big Read grant in 2008, and it encouraged us again to reach into the community and make it into a community effort. Uh-huh. It was a great program. And at that time, Dana Goya was the, I want to say president, that's probably the wrong word, of the National Endowment for the Arts, uh-huh. NEA. Uh-huh. He said at the time, he said that the rate of literacy in our country has decreased so much that, you know, we were in danger of becoming a country that wouldn't even be able to understand well enough to have a democracy anymore, because you have to have people that are educated enough and able to process information to be able to vote and to be able to know what they're voting for. Uh-huh. And I think he made a great point. And whether or not we're doing all we can, I don't know, but I do think it's a great start. And I think having people sit around and be able to talk about things they've read and discuss them and relate what they're reading to things they already know. I was at a conference last week and said that education's impossible. You're never going to be able to teach anybody anything new unless they can relate it to something they've already had a little bit of experience with. They won't have a way to connect. Uh-huh. And I think reading a whole novel works your brain in a way that texting does not. Uh-huh. And, you know, flashing through emails, flashing through Facebook. I think connecting with an entire book is an experience and a brain activity that is important. And it's becoming a lost art, but I think that we're trying our best to revive that.
That was Kay Brown, co-organizer of the Common Reading Program in Owensboro. A number of published writers attended this week's event. They spoke to and worked with students at Owensboro Community and Technical College. Coming up on The Trend, local poet Peggy Pirro joins us to talk about and read from her new book. Stay with us.
Support for WNIN comes in part from Rabun Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Rabun offers a selection of tire brands including Michelin and Goodyear, along with complete auto service and recommended maintenance by trained technicians. Information on the web at RabunTire.com.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. And joining me now in the studio is poet, musician, entrepreneur. I could go on. It's Peggy Pirro.
Hi, John.
Thanks for coming in, Peggy. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, we should point out right off the top that your new collection of poems, it's called Beautiful Terrible World.
Mm-hmm.
It's you go by the name P.S. Pirro.
Yes.
So folks are looking in the library or on Amazon, they should be looking for P.S. Pirro, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Yes. All right. Well, now it's just been published. Beautiful, Terrible World. Can you explain that title?
Sure. I think I'd probably need to start by telling you that I have a practice that I've been keeping up for a couple of years. And I write a poem every day.
Yeah.
They're often very short. They're seldom very good. But I do it every single day. And over the course of several years, I accumulate a body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And from those, I would say maybe 10%, 15% are something that I can develop and mm-hmm. that have some quality to them. And the others, they might have some little bits that that I can pull out and use. As I write these, occasionally a good one will come up, and I'll post it to my blog, which is pspiro.com.
Uh-huh.
And one of my I'm an irregular blogger. I'm an infrequent blogger. I'm a bad blogger.
Yeah, me too, as a matter of fact.
But I really do like it, and I've kept a blog for quite a long time. And when I go on hiatus from my blog, I usually tell my three readers that I'm going to be gone for a little while. And the last time I did, one of my readers left a comment saying that they would miss my poetry. And to not let this terrible world silence my voice. Mm-hmm. And that sentiment stayed with me because in so many ways, it is a pretty terrible world. Mm-hmm. So many terrible, terrible things happen, and we do so many terrible things to each other in this world. And but that the sentiment is not certainly not the whole story, because there is an enormous amount of beauty in the world too, and there's probably seldom a day that goes by that I'm not grateful, you know, to be alive. Uh-huh. So in deciding what to call the book, that phrase stuck with me, but I really needed to add that extra word
I see.
To it.
But both beauty and terror as it comes together. You mentioned this everyday practice, mm-hmm. or an everyday approach. Mm-hmm. We talked earlier in the hour to Brian Kimmerling about his approach. He says at one time he hit sort of a block. But do you find this, would you sort of call this sort of a mind dump kind of a thing? I mean, that that regardless, every day, write something down? It works for you, obviously.
Well, the poems are a little more deliberate than what I would refer to as a mind dump, because I also do morning pages, which is three pages of longhand every morning, and that really is a mind dump. That is just clearing the cobwebs out in the day, and occasionally a phrase or two will come up or a theme or two will emerge from the morning pages, but they truly are not writing as I would think of writing. It's mm-hmm. scribbling. The poems are a more deliberate practice. They're almost like a meditation, perhaps they are a meditation. Uh-huh. And just sitting down and allowing a feeling, an emotion, a sense of where I am at that moment or what I have been most involved with in my thinking and in my perceptions of the life that I'm living at that particular mm-hmm. time. These are the things that come out in the morning poems. And as I say, most of them are not good. I don't mean not good in terms of, and they're not negative, but I mean the work is not particularly good. Right.
But over time.
Over time, I think if you include enough quantity in your life of the thing that you most love to do, and in my life it's a lot of writing. If you include enough quantity, I think quality will eventually emerge, or at least put its little finger in the up above the surface so you can grab it and maybe make something of it.
Right. Now, in full disclosure, I haven't had time to read all the poems in the book. I've certainly heard some of your material. It strikes me that some of your poems are dark and sad. Others are funny. Maybe some are all three at once. Can you tell me what inspires these pieces?
Well, they come from life, and life is dark and sad and funny energetic and vivid, and mm-hmm. all the things that inform the poetry are just the things that are in my life. And the more, I suppose, a lot of them have to do with where I am in any particular phase in my life.
Sure,
so
sure.
If I'm spending a lot of time in nature, for example, it'll come out in the poetry. And if I'm spending a lot of time walking city streets or looking at power lines, those will come out in the poetry.
Right, right. Well, speaking of your poetry, would you like to share something with us here?
Sure.
So long as it's radio-friendly, as I told Brian.
This first one, I was thinking earlier about that, and I don't even think there's a single swear word in this whole uh-huh. collection of poems, so I think we're pretty safe.
Okay.
This first one is part of the first section of the book. The book is divided into three sections, and the first one is called Geography, and it has to do, in a lot of ways, with my coming to understand Southern Indiana as my home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a permanent home. It's certainly been my home for the past, I think, 16, a lot of years.
Uh-huh.
I think I came here in 1997. So anyway, this is from the first section of the book. The poem is called 292.
Mm-hmm.
292 mountains no longer exist. Blown to the winds, to the streams, to the faucets of eastern Kentucky. I throw a switch in Indiana and they blow right through my door. 292 mountains. Dust in the toes of my shoes. And that, of course, is a reference to the mountaintop mining.
Mountaintop mining.
Been decimating West Virginia and a lot of the
Eastern Kentucky, too,
Eastern
I guess.
Eastern Kentucky,
right?
Sure.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So I'd say that...
Is that a sad one?
Yeah, that's sort of a sad one.
Is that a dark one?
I'd say there's both some beauty and some terrible there, I would guess. Again, recalling the title of your book. Would you like to share another one there that might be a little different?
This one is touches a little bit more directly on my my efforts to integrate myself and find a home here in Indiana. It's called All Things Being Equal. Mm-hmm. It can't be about the running anymore. It can't be about the treasure illusory as the rainbow under which it never really waited. It can't be about the waiting. It's astonishing how long it takes to grow into a life. Maybe I'm just a slow learner, having spent so many of my young years running and waiting. I went as far as I could go without falling into the ocean, as high as I could climb without losing my grip or passing out from lack of oxygen. Geography is cruel, sweeping me up with its fat-fingered Midwestern hands and setting me down gently in this place I'd never choose, all things being equal. But all things are never equal. Not oceans, not mountains, not gentle hands and people who call me ma'am and say nice things to me, even when I'm not listening.
Very good. That's Peggy Pirro. She goes by the name P.S. Pirro, and she's reading from her new book of poetry, Beautiful, Terrible World. Well, you touched on it, Peggy, that you're not an Evansville native, but you have stuck around for a number of years.
Yeah.
This also gets back a bit to what we were talking with Brian Kimberling earlier in the show. What inspires your poetry and music living here in southern Indiana?
Oh, God. The characters that I run into, of course, I've had a lot of work here that has put me in contact, in direct contact with a lot of interesting people, beginning, of course, with running the coffee house, and that's Penny Lane.
Yes, we should point out, if you enjoy Penny Lane Coffee House, you have this woman to thank. Peggy opened and operated Penny Lane for a number of years, and I think a lot of folks thank you for that.
Yeah, we opened in 2000 when there really wasn't... I think the second Flying Saucer had recently closed, and there was such a void in the community for a coffee house. So it was a wonderful place for me because having only lived here at the time for about 2.5 years, it was an opportunity to see people, to talk to people, and to become a part of the segment of the community that most interested me, which was the people who go to coffee houses, who go to poetry readings, who like open mic events, who like independent music, and who just like hanging out and drinking coffee.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So. So
you find lots of inspiration. I'm guessing we can find some of these characters in your poetry.
Not so much the people, because in this particular collection, it is the feelings of living in this space, which occasionally mention people, but you're more likely to see the river in these poems or to see dirt or birds on power lines or, the physical attributes of this community. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time, and we thank you so much for coming in. That's
Peggy
Pirro.
It was my pleasure.
P.S. Pirro, that is. Her new collection of poems is called Beautiful, Terrible World. I'd like to thank all my guests, Brian Kimberling, the author of the novel Snapper, Marcus Wicker of USI and the new Harmony Writers series, Kay Brown of Owensboro Community and Technical College, and once again, poet Peggy Pirro of Newburgh. Also thanks to Cass Harrington and Mallory Klum. I'm John Gibson. This is WNIN-FM, Henderson and Owensboro.